Thanks for joining us. Starting tonight, writer Claire Adam grew up in Trinidad to a Cork mother, and her second novel has made it onto this year's Booker Prize longlist. The story of a young girl being sent away to give birth is set in Trinidad, but it's one that we here would definitely recognise. Claire Adam joins me now from London. Claire, thanks for joining us on Arena.
Hello there. Hi, it's great to be here.
Congratulations on the long listing. Tell us the story of Love Forms.
Oh, thank you. No, honestly, this is such an honour and it's such a surprise. Like the book only came out in June and in July in the US. And so this has just been such a whirlwind and such a thrill. Love Forms. So it opens in the Caribbean. The main character is a young woman, 16 years old, called Dawn. And she gets pregnant and she's from this very sort of respectable family. And they send her across the ocean to Venezuela, where she has to have the baby and give it up for adoption in secret. And then we pick up with her several decades later. And at that stage, she's living in London and she's sort of had a life. She's been married, but now divorced. And she has two sons who are grown up. But it turns out that she's never really forgotten this baby that she had in Venezuela. And then what happens is that a woman gets in touch on the internet, sort of claiming to be her long-lost daughter. So that's kind of where it starts. And, I mean, really what the novel is about is something to do with the sort of pull of motherhood. Like motherhood, you know, of course, on one hand, it's totally ordinary and it's sort of very mundane. It's something we take for granted. But on the other hand, that connection in a way is quite sort of mysterious and inexplicable. And I guess in the case of, like, here we have these two people, this mother and daughter, who basically don't know each other, and yet they have this sort of pull towards each other or this yearning to reconnect. So that was kind of what I was exploring.
Yeah, one of the more interesting kind of subplots of the book is the conflict as to whether Dawn would have had a better life if she'd kept her baby, or whether or not that was maybe something good that happened to her in the long run in terms of her own life. It's a really interesting kind of tension.
I think it's something that she sort of struggles with. When we see her in the book, she's divorced and the sons are grown up. So she's kind of in this house alone and she is kind of facing, she's in her mid-50s, but she's 58 and she's kind of at this resting point, I guess, in her life where she's kind of found herself alone and she has time to look back. And, she kind of keeps on thinking that she's taken a wrong turn somewhere. And she thinks where, and her mind kind of keeps on going back to things that are in the past. And she keeps on kind of returning to this moment and sort of trying to, this moment in Venezuela where she had the baby and she was parted from the baby. And it's kind of, she kind of keeps on thinking that something went wrong and she doesn't quite know how to explain what's happened to her life since then.
Yeah, and it affects her relationship with her parents in the story as well, because they obviously at the time think that they're acting in her best interest.
Yeah, of course. This is the thing. I mean, so that part of the story happens in 1980. So, this is a while ago. And Trinidad, many similarities to Ireland, I'm sure. Like, Trinidad at that time was certainly very conservative, certainly for the sort of, middle class or upper class kind of respectable people. Of course you can sort of cast parents as all these evil parents. They were trying to control you and they were forcing you to do this and that. But they also thought they were doing their best for her. At that time, for a 16-year-old girl to have a baby at that time and be so stigmatized and the reality of having a baby is you're there changing nappies, you're pushing her on the pram. I mean, it's not an easy life. Mm-hmm. And so, what they envisioned for her was that they were sort of freeing her and that she would be freeing herself. So there are many different religions in Trinidad, but, this particular family would have been Catholic. And, so abortion was just not something that was part of the discussion at all. And so I think they felt that the best thing they could do was to, to sort of kind of shroud it in secrecy so that the shame would kind of be minimized. I think they thought they were doing the right thing for her and she trusted them. She was only 16 and she was from sort of quite a, quite a, you know, a well-off family, and she'd always felt safe and secure, and she trusted them. But then so many years later in her life, then she looks back and wonders whether she should have trusted them so much.
This idea of pregnant Trinidadian girls going to Venezuela, is that something that actually happened?
You know, so, I mean, it's not autobiographical in that sense. Like, it's not something that happened to me. I mean, I do, of course, know of some stories. I don't personally know girls who went to Venezuela. But the thing, like, you know, it is something that girls would kind of disappear. And I think that this is, I'm sure, you know, we all know this is something that happens in Ireland as well. You know, girls kind of disappear, you know, for 9 months and then kind of magically reappear, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, Trinidad being such a small island, there's only kind of limited places that people can go. And so for her to go to Venezuela, like, actually the crossing to Venezuela is not an easy crossing. So Trinidad is an island, and so we're just off the sort of the northeast coast of South America. So Venezuela being our closest neighbor. So it's 7 miles away. But so, like, it's not, you know, for her to go across, she had to go by night. When I say these things, I'm, you know, this is a fictional story, but, like, it feels very real to me. So she had to go by night, and, you know, there are pirates on that stretch of water, and they come and take your boat engine and they throw you in the sea. You know, there's Coast Guard, there's the, you know, there's this, the Venezuelan equivalent of the Coast Guard. She had to cover her head with a hood so that nothing would reflect in torchlight. So it's a very frightening journey for her. And also, you know, her family would have had to pay, like, it's not easy to ensure your safety as you go across that water. Like, once I kind of understood how she would get from A to B, I realized she would have to be actually quite a wealthy, she's from quite a wealthy family. So that kind of became part of the story.
I hadn't really realized those close connections between Trinidad and Venezuela until I read Golden Child in 2019, your debut novel. It's a story about a mother and daughter, your current novel. The debut is a story about a father and a son. And it kind of struck me that the moral dilemmas of parenthood, that must be something that interests you as a writer.
I suppose it is. I mean, I don't know what I'm going to do for my third novel. Like, I've done fathers and sons and now mothers and daughters. I don't know. I mean, and in both cases, there's sort of a lost child or a missing child. And I don't know. I mean, like, this really is not something that comes from sort of the immediate surrounds of my life. Maybe in a previous generation, there was somebody and there's something epigenetic going on. I have no idea. I suppose it's just, you know, we all have families, whether, you know, and with all their complications. And so it's, everybody kind of knows, you know, so much about a family just from being so close to them. So it's kind of, it's the place that so many of us start, isn't it, in our writing?
Yeah, tell me a little bit about Trinidad, maybe, because an awful lot of people have preconceptions about pretty much everywhere in the Caribbean, about how beautiful they are, about paradise. Yeah. There's a dark underbelly to the country, certainly in recent decades.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, and there is this sort of strange connection, like, that I can't totally explain between Trinidad and Ireland as well. I mean, so I was born in Trinidad. I grew up there. So I lived there until I was 18. And my mom, of course, is Irish. So she's from County Cork, as you said. So, like, that was kind of, you know, one connect. But there were quite a few Irish families. And we have the Irish priests and nuns, and we have that as well. But so Trinidad, I mean, you know, I have to say it was just a fabulous place to grow up. Like, you know, and when I was there recently, somebody said, you know, like, there really is no better place than Trinidad to grow up, you know, because we have the beach, we have the outdoors, the society is so friendly, you know, you're always in and out of your neighbor house, like, the food is just to die for, like, all that is really good. We have plenty sunshine, you know, vitamin D every single day, like, all that part is very good, you know. I mean, things kind of change a little bit by the time you reach to be an adult. Things change a little bit, you know, because then you kind of hit up against the realities of life a little bit. And I mean, you know, I don't want to come on radio and bad talk the place, but I mean, the thing is, like, Trinidad has, you know, we have oil and natural gas. So in principle, we should be a very rich country. But then you go to Trinidad and you do not see wealth around the place. You see a lot of people who don't have water and they live in shacks, and, you know, people, you know, they go to hospital and they don't get the treatment. And then you have to kind of wonder, well, why is that? So, you know, people could put two and two together and figure out why is that. But that, you know, that certainly is part of the problem that Trinidad is facing.
Yeah, you've mentioned your mum. So tell me about her. She was born in Cork. How did she end up in Trinidad?
Well, so she was a doctor. No, she's still around. So she went over to England and she did. Let me get this straight. So she went to
probably
UCD,
important. Just if your mum's going to hear this.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. She's probably listening. So she met my dad in England. They were both doctors and they were working in a hospital together. And then they went back to the Caribbean together. So that's how that happened. And then so there were four of us kids. I'm the youngest of the four. And yeah, so we had a brilliant time growing up in Trinidad, and we used to come to Ireland. It was every 3 years that we used to come, kind of like migrating birds, and it was just a highlight of our childhood. We just loved it so much. And of course, Trinidad being tropical, is where we come in from is hot. And so we go into Ireland, we have to get sweaters, you know, we pack up all our cold weather clothes for, even though we're coming in June, July, August, we're like, oh gosh, this place is going to be cold, you know. So we came over, and yes, so we were down in West Cork, so down Skibbereen, Loch Ine area. And we, you know, all, so my mum is one of eight, and so all the, you know, the whole family would be down, not for the whole summer, but they'd come down at weekends, and so we saw all our cousins. And I mean, really, it was just a highlight of our childhood. It was just so wonderful. There was, you know, there was the lake, the water was so cold, but there were all these fruits that we'd never, you know, that we weren't used to. There were strawberries, raspberries, gooseberries, all the berries, you know, all those things. So we just had so much fun.
Is it something that you still do? Do you still go back to your grandmother's place in Cork?
Yeah, we do. So that really is wonderful. So my grandmother, she was one of those legendary ladies who lived, I think she lived to 108, I think. So that was wonderful. And, you know, luckily we've managed to sort of keep the place where, you know, the house and garden that she lived in, we've managed to keep it in the family. So that is amazing that we could, you know, I do go back and my kids love going back, and it's kind of a place for the whole family to gather. So it's wonderful.
Talk to me a little bit, because I've seen you talk before about this in an interview recently in particular, about how Trinidad has a really great tradition of oral storytelling, and about how Trinidad is quite a social place. But in the interview, I think you were speaking to an interviewer in the UK and you were drawing comparisons as to how different the UK was. But that sounds quite similar to an Irish storytelling tradition and to a kind of Irish surrounds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I mean, so I think that is an interesting thing, I think, about Trinidad, you know, certainly in terms of its similarity to Ireland, is, you know, Trinidad, so it's a hot place. So people are more, you know, now I live in London and this is a, you know, it's a temperate climate and people are more likely to kind of sit inside. We get a bit sealed up. We sit inside our houses or our flats and we kind of stay inside. Whereas, you know, I think it is partly to do with the climate of Trinidad in the tropics. But, you know, everybody, you can't stay inside your house. You have to come outside. And so people being outside sort of where it's cooler or where there's shade, or, you know, also you have to, you know, maybe this is more rural setting, but you also kind of have to, you're sort of forced to come out for, you know, maybe it's where the water is. You have to come to the river, or you have to come to the standpipe or those sorts of things. And so people do gather. And in gathering, then, you know, there's obviously the, you know, storytelling is kind of part and parcel of that. Yes, which I think, you know, I know that that's the case in Ireland as well.
Well, it's a little bit like Ireland, probably about 10 days a year or so. And the rest of the year, we kind of get on with it. I'm also really interested in that you didn't start writing until your children were past a certain point as well. And they're now older teenagers. How did you start writing? Do you have any advice for people who think that maybe that they might have missed the boat and that there's still time for them to write?
Oh, yeah, well, so that's true. I'd always sort of thought about writing. It was always something that had been kind of in the back of my mind. I thought, well, one day I'll start doing this. And, you know, I used to keep a notebook and there were times when I'd sort of, you know, be writing something and it's kind of scribbling or kind of, I mean, sometimes it was quite a lot, but I always just kind of threw it away. It just seemed a bit pointless, like it wasn't really going anywhere. But yes, so then it was, you know, when my kids were born, I sort of, you know, it's like the fear seized me that, you know, the kind of like life is not forever. And if you want to do something, you have to start today. So that was kind of when I started, I think, when I really started in earnest and thought, okay, I'm not going to stop until I get somewhere. But yeah, you know, I do a bit of you know, sort of teaching and mentoring just on a sort of a small scale. And I mean, I see people, you know, at all ages. I think it's quite common for people in sort of middle age or older age to sort of think, you know, right, you know, no more messing about. Like, now is the time. I'm going to do this now. So that's what I would say to anybody who's thinking about it. It's like, don't wait. Do it now. Get your notebook out right now.
You've been to Claire Keegan's writing workshops as well. What was that
yes.
like?
Yes. Oh, she's wonderful. And I'm sure that many listeners will be sort of cheering whenever Claire's name comes up. So what it was is that I'd read Foster. And I read Foster and I put it down as like, oh my God, who is this woman? And of course, I went straight to Google and was like, Google Claire Keegan, where? I didn't know anything about her. And I realized, oh, she's contemporary. She's here. Like, she could have been, you know, she's so timeless. She could have been from 100 years ago. What do I know? And I thought, oh, she's around now. And I was like, oh my God, she does workshops. So I really was nearly beside myself. And she actually was, I think, you know, she was doing a workshop in London actually quite soon at the time that I was looking her up. So I signed up straight away and I got myself down there. And I mean, she is fabulous, as you know, all of her students, I'm sure, will attest. She's a super generous teacher. So it's been a privilege. So I've done two workshops with her, and you know, if anybody's thinking about it, you should absolutely sign up.
It would seem a strange interview if I didn't mention at some point that your first book, Golden Child, has been optioned by Sarah Jessica Parker's company. Probably the sort of thing you've been asked about 100 times, but nonetheless, and I am conscious that, you know, frequently these things take a very long time to come to fruition. How is that going?
Yeah. I mean, so it's an option by a young producer who's in LA. So that's amazing. And as you know, like, options are just, you know, it's kind of just the beginning of a journey. So it really can be a very long journey. And like, all the writer has to do is just kind of, we just sit quietly and we just wait for news. And if people, you know, if they need anything from me, then I'm here and I'll, you know, I'll read anything or I'll talk to anybody. But yes, I mean, there's nothing. So I don't think there's anything I can report just now. It's you know, it's everybody is feeling very good and we're feeling hopeful and I'm feeling good. And yes, and it's wonderful that Sarah Jessica Parker's production company, you know, kind of, you know, I actually don't really know exactly what the arrangement is, but it's some sort of, you know, producer link or something. As I say, like, I'm a little bit
a complicated
sort of
business
of this,
at best.
Yes, exactly. So like, that's wonderful because it's just kind of a you know, it's a show of support. So that's amazing.
And so maybe just finally, because we are talking to you about the long listing for the Booker Prize, what has that been like? How did you find out? What has the time been like in the kind of couple of weeks since that's happened? How's that been for you?
Yeah. I mean, it's been amazing, and it's been like, it's a total shift of gear. Like, you know, I wrote this book took me like 5 years to write. And you can picture me sitting in my house quietly. You know, I live a very quiet life. I'm not the kind of person who can go out a lot, you know, who can kind of be partying, you know, one day and writing the next. I just have to go very quietly. And yeah, so the news came, I think it was 2 o'clock on a Tuesday. And like, in previous years, I think authors have been told before, but this year it's all changed and there's NDAs everywhere and nobody was told. So like, I just basically at 2 o'clock, I started getting, my phone started pinging and my email started going and I was like, what's going on? And this was it. And like, so honestly, so I think the first thing came in at 2 o'clock saying, well, congratulations. And I did not get up from my computer until about 10 o'clock at night. It was just congratulations. I mean, it was just like, it was wonderful, but it's also crazy. But listen, I'm so grateful. Like, this is, it's like a miracle has happened. You know, there's a lot of competition for readers and for attention, and to, you know, get anywhere near a prize like this is every author's dream. So like, I'm truly, truly grateful and honored.
Well, our fingers are crossed for you, and it's been lovely to talk to you tonight. Claire, thank you so much. The Kilkenny Arts Festival is underway at the moment. Its usual mix of music, theatre, art and more is running until the 17th of August. Helen Meaney has been to see a couple of shows for us. Actor Peter Hanley explores his own experience of stage fright in What Are You Afraid Of? At the Watergate Theatre. And Neon Dusk takes us outside to the Castle Yard for a show that's part acrobatics, part performance art. I'm delighted that Helen joins me in studio now. We're going to start with the Neon Dusk show first, Helen. It's performed by its three creators, Jonah McGreevy, a regular visitor to the Kilkenny Arts Festival, and Mafalda Gonçalves and Daniel Seabra from Portugal. What can you tell us about them first off?
Well, they have their own company called Circo. Oh my goodness, what are they called? Sorry, Chaotico, bit like me. And they've been to Ireland before. They were in Cork last year, and this is the first time that Jonah McGreevy and they have joined forces, because Jonah is normally with his own company, Lucy Smokes, and so it's a really stripped back. You would call it spectacle or sort of modern circus come acrobatics, and it's just the three of them, and it's outdoors in the castle yard, and it's just a very bare stage that is slightly raised from the ground so the audience can see it. And in the beginning, it's just the two men, and they're joined by Mafalda Gonçalves, and it's almost as if they're the three of them are in combat in some way, or it's very confrontational, the movement. They're sort of almost taunting each other, confronting each other, then withdrawing, flinging themselves at each other. And then they start actually climbing on top of each other with no supports, no ropes, no bars, no beams. It's just an amazing feat of physical strength. And it's utterly riveting, actually.
It's 45 minutes long, so it's a relatively short performance. It gets off to a very, very intense start. Is that what happens at the very beginning? You've described that as being an incredibly intense from the word go.
Yes. So at the beginning, the first thing that happens is that Jonah McCreevy walks onto the stage, and his whole neck, his face, and even his eyes are covered and wrapped around by a long rope. And then it's being pulled by Daniel Seabra, the other performer, the Portuguese performer, who's behind him and follows him on stage. And eventually Jonah McCreevy starts spinning on the ground and in the air, and so the rope begins to unfurl from around his face and his neck. But that, it's a slow movement, but he eventually frees himself, and then the two men are sort of grappling, spinning around each other, bumping up against each other, and they're looking at each other, they're sort of eyeballing each other really intensely, and you think, you start wondering, what is the, is this, are they lovers, or is there some narrative here about their kind of the way they're wrapping their bodies around each other? And while that's all happening and you're sort of totally focused on that, then the third performer walks in. And you know, Mafalda Gonçalves is a tiny, tiny figure. She's really petite, but she's immensely strong. So this is where it's almost like, it reminds me of like a bullfight or flamenco, that kind of energy of defiance, where she's almost saying, look, see what I can do now. And then they start throwing her around the stage. And as in, they have, one of them has one of her legs and the other, and they're spinning her on the ground and then right up through the air, circling and circling, until she's actually standing with one foot on one of their shoulders and the other on the other, and then walking between them, somersaulting in the air, backflipping and landing on one or the other of them, and managing somehow not to break into any kind of, nothing falters. It's completely unwavering, and they're looking at each other the whole time with this incredible intensity. And so it's almost like they're challenging each other. It's quite disturbing, the energy at times. It's quite confrontational.
What sort of soundtrack is accompanying this?
So there's a kind of pulsating, thrumming, and there's no credit for the sound, so I presume it's the three artists have chosen this. It's a kind of a haunting, thrumming sound, and the lights, it's outdoors at 9 o'clock, so the lights begin to fall, so dusk is coming, and it's lit very simply and plainly through solar panels. So it's so exposing for the three performers, because there is no set of any kind. There's nothing visual other than their bodies grappling and spinning. It becomes very, very absorbing. And you feel that there's some kind of very serious combative energy there, almost as if they're pushing their bodies as far as they can possibly go. It's an incredibly risky performance, because actually any of them could slip and fall at any time and break their bones. And so there's a huge amount of trust between them. They're throwing each other around and climbing on top of each other. So there's a sense, there's no narrative. So you're left as a viewer to just you know, let it make whatever impression it makes on you, and you're inferring things. So my sense of it was that there's a tension between them individually trying to strive to do the most daring thing, and then also this kind of impulse towards cradling each other's bodies and holding each other as if they're looking for some kind of deeper connection. And that was just my sense of it, and that's there's a push-pull throughout of that, of those kind of contrasting and almost fragmentary impulses. And so it's very abstract.
It sounds extraordinary.
It is extraordinary. Very, I mean, so. you're torn between feeling slightly uneasy, particularly when they're throwing her around, and then thinking, no, this is just spellbinding in its artistry and in its skill, actually.
Okay, that is Neon Dusk. We're going to take a look at Peter Hanley's What Are You Afraid Of in a couple of minutes. We are with this year's Kilkenny Arts Festival. Helen Meaney is still in studio with me here, and you're listening to Monday Night's Arena. Peter Hanley reunites with director Lynn Parker and Rough Magic in What Are You Afraid Of? He would have been a regular member of Rough Magic shows in the noughties. What else would people know him from?
Oh, he's been a lot of television as well, like Ballykiss Angel and Braveheart, film Braveheart. And he's, you know, many, many productions over the years at The Gate and The Abbey. I particularly remember his performance in Communion, a play by Aidan Matthews, Abbey production. It's on the Peacock stage in 2002, where he played him a young man who was bedridden, who was terminally ill with cancer. Very difficult role, but he brought to it just such a kind of depth of feeling. I think that's what Peter Hanley, I mean, for me as an actor, he had this capacity to be vulnerable. Yeah. And I really remember that production and his performance.
And he was immensely in demand as an actor in the 90s and in the noughties. When did he start to have serious problems with stage fright?
Well, this began, it was a terrible experience for him during the Gate Theatre production of Brian Friel's Molly Sweeney, and that was in 2011. And what happened was that he started feeling this absolute panic and anxiety, acute anxiety, that he wouldn't be able to remember his lines. And that's when it started, and he kept going for almost a year, which is actually incredible. He just, you know, was just about managing, though I don't think it was obvious, and eventually he just withdrew from acting, which must have been really difficult. And so he spent the time then trying to recover, and it wasn't stage fright. He wasn't afraid of being on the stage. It was actually very specifically about forgetting his lines. So now he's turned that experience into this autobiographical play in which he performs himself, or a version of himself.
Yeah, it seems interesting that writing has been one of the ways he's been dealing with having to step away from acting, and now he has written the script for What You're Afraid Of, and now he's performing it as well. So how does he approach this material, which is essentially the story of his own recent life?
Yeah, it's really carefully shaped, and you can see that it's been worked on. There was actually a work in progress of this at last year's Kilkenny Arts Festival. Now, I didn't see that, but you can tell that a lot of thought has gone into the shaping and the structuring of this, and it's so delicately and well directed by Lynn Parker. You can just imagine the kinds of long conversations that they all had during rehearsal, because there's nothing self-pitying about this. It's actually quite playful, even though it's a very serious subject. And Peter Hanley is really putting himself out there and making himself vulnerable by talking about this terrible thing that's happened to him in his life. But there is a lot of humour, and a lot of it revolves around stagecraft itself, about him waiting for his cue, or a very extremely bossy stage manager or ordering him up on stage and him saying, I'm not even in this play. So there's a lot of jokes about theatricality and about just stagecraft, which he loves, which Peter Hanley, it's one of the things that he misses, is all of that.
Yeah, because we haven't mentioned that as of yet, but it's not just solely Peter Hanley. He does bring up the bossy stage manager played by Niamh McAllister. What's she like?
Yes, he's so she's on. She's you know, in his on a voiceover, but we hear her too, and she then starts. So it's almost like a voice in his head. So she starts telling him that he's you know a loser and a quitter and all of that self-loathing. The inner critic voice from Peter Hanley is all kind of given to her. But then he has a more kindly, kind of supportive presence on stage, played by Donal Herdman, who plays Peter Hanley's own grandfather, who died actually before he was even born. And there's some lovely, very playful interaction between him and his grandfather, who was an apprentice draper in Cleary's back in, you know, the early 20th century, whoops. And he remembers going to Parnell's funeral and things like that. There are lovely touches. And he's really becomes quite a kindly voice to combat the extremely critical voice of the stage manager. And he calls himself his guardian angel. So there are lots of scenes with him, but there's also Niamh McAllister then plays various therapists, psychotherapists, and then there's one that she's kind of cleansing Peter Hanley's aura. He tries everything, including meditation and, you know, God knows what. I must say therapists do not come out well in this play. I mean, the butt of the humour is definitely the therapist. And, you know, either she's looking at her watch, not interested, or she says, I'm going to do this healing remotely, you know, and here's, you know, are you paying cash or card? It's, you know, anyway, that there's a lot of humour.
But part of the story is though about his own stage fright, and then with the grandfather character, it moves towards the sort of confusion that his own elderly parents went through as well. He draws those kind of parallels as well, doesn't he?
He does. So there's a history. They didn't have really serious dementia, but they were developing dementia, his own parents, in their later years. And he was taking care of them he was the one, as he said, the actor in the family who had time on his hands. And I think what's underlying that is a fear of some kind of inherited, a psychological or a mental condition. But then at the beginning of the play, as the audience goes in, we're asked to write out on a card what are we afraid of individually. And so Peter Hanley starts reading out the answers to that question, what are you afraid of, that the audience members have written. And a lot of them are about losing one's mind or developing dementia or Alzheimer's. And that was interesting. So there's that sense of, what are you afraid of? I'm afraid of my own mind, you know, or of losing my mind. That came up. But the other thing is that it becomes more universal. It goes beyond thinking about acting and the craft of acting, even though that's explored a lot. It's very much about, did nobody miss me, he's saying, over all these years that I haven't been acting? Like, did I not make any difference? You know, what has been my kind of contribution, if you like, to the world or to life as an actor? And now that I'm not an actor, who am I? I mean, and that's the question that resonates with a lot of people at different times of their life. If you're switching careers, or if you, I don't know, you're made redundant, or you retire, or any of those pivotal points, you know, who am I now if I'm not doing that thing that I identified so completely with? And there's a specific analogy between being an actor and being a priest at one point. And the point of that is, was that my vocation? And if I cannot do that, what can I do? And I mean, they're questions that are very kind of touching and moving. And I think anyone in the audience can relate to that. And then you see gradually, with a lot of support from the grandfather, the ghost of his grandfather, you know, he admits that, look, he's changing and growing, and he starts writing, and that writing might be his, not vocation, but it's what he's going to do next. So it's not one of those redemptive kind of arcs. He's saying, look, I still can't act without a script. So it's not as if he's had some kind of miraculous transformation, but he's found some other way of expressing himself. And I think that's, you know, in the end, that's very affecting, and it's affirming and brave as well. But it's not simplistic, and it's not cliched. So it's a fine balance, I think, that comes in the direction to tell that story in a way that is kind of uplifting without being cliched.
And in terms of Peter Hanley's own performance, because I presume there's a very fine line when you're playing a character that is based on you, but getting that right, do you think he has?
Well, I suppose only he could answer that, you know, but yes, I think so. I mean, and that's where I think the bravery, I think it's a courageous thing to do. And he talks about things that are not easy. He talks about the years when he was, you know, maybe not a good parent to his younger children, maybe losing his temper when he'd lost all his work, and things that are he probably didn't need to say, but that help make him a credible character. I suppose he's not really a character, but he's a version of himself. And he talked a lot about, he goes back in some of the therapy sessions, he goes back to his childhood, so we learn a bit about him as a shy, introverted boy who discovered acting as a teenager, which kind of saved him, you know. And so we do learn a lot about him. But there is a light touch, and the humour with his grandfather and with the therapist, that slightly changes the tone and makes it less confessional. And there's a lot of artifice and artistry in this. So there are kind of many layers to it.
It seems like a very good point to ask you, and I know you touched on it earlier on, but what does Lynn Parker bring as a director to this play, do you think?
I think sensitivity. Knowing the theatre world, knowing him, and knowing the craft, and having a great fun with the craft of acting. There's a video scene of him with big close up on Peter Hanley's face where he's at a party. Typical questions that people will ask. So, you know, it's great you're an actor. How do you remember all those lines? How do you remember all those lines? And they keep repeating that question. And the other question is, what's Mel Gibson like? You know, so there's a lot of jokes just about the nature of working in theatre and being a performer, and of course Lynn Parker would bring all that, but also it's very, very well shaped and structured. It's tight, it's really tight. It's only like 75 minutes, but there's a whole life in there, so it's a very, very rich experience.
It is 75 minutes, as you say. It's interval free as well. I'm an immense fan of that. It presumably sustains that length well for you. Are you recommending it?
I'm really recommending it. Yeah, I mean, I think it's exactly the length it needs to be, and the shape and the form seem perfectly knitted to it. So it's a very satisfying piece of theatre. It's actually finishing in Kilkenny tomorrow, but it's going to Dublin Theatre Festival at Smock Alley, the main stage, at the end of September. So there'll be another chance for audiences to see it.
Helen Meaney, it has been lovely talking to you tonight. Thank you for going to Kilkenny and seeing both of those productions for us. Neon Dusk is at the Castle Yard in Kilkenny until August 17th. And What Are You Afraid Of by Peter Hanley at the Watergate until tomorrow, Tuesday, August 12th. And as Helen says, it then goes to Smock Alley Theatre in Dublin between the 25th of September and the 4th of October as part of this year's Dublin Theatre Festival. More details at kilkennyarts.ie and at dublintheatrefestival.ie as well. Thank you. Well, the Irish connections to George Frederick Handel and his masterwork The Messiah are well known, but the Irish Baroque Orchestra is exploring another of his famous oratorios, Alexander's Feast, which also has ties to Dublin. On Thursday and Friday of this week, the orchestra will perform the piece in Kilkenny and Dublin, and at the end of this month, they'll perform it as part of the BBC Proms in the hallowed surrounds of London's Royal Albert Hall. I'm delighted to be joined by Peter Whelan, who's the artistic director and the conductor of the Irish Baroque Orchestra. Peter, why this particular piece and why now?
Well, we've been exploring music in Ireland in the 18th century, and it's been a whirlwind trip. Of course, it always comes back to Messiah, comes back to Fishamble Street and Handel visiting the city. Of course, it was a big turning point for him. His fortunes changed when he was in Ireland, so we have a lot to be proud of. And my own personal journey and the journey of the Irish Baroque Orchestra is to explore the people that Handel found in Dublin, the musicians and music that he played when he was here. And this, the Alexander's Feast, is the next level, basically. Everybody knows about Messiah and its premiere, and that, of course, is a huge piece and something for us to be really proud of, that we had the premiere in Ireland. But this Alexander's Feast, it's the next chapter in the story. So basically, we're going to present an Irish version of Handel's Alexander's Feast, and that's going to be played in Kilkenny Festival and in our own Handel Fest on Friday, and then in the Albert Hall. So it's basically Handel was in Ireland. He had a great time. It didn't all go totally smoothly for him when he was here. I mean, he was wined and dined within an inch of his life. People loved him. And he was, he had a little mini stroke at some point because he was so well wined and dined in Henrietta Street, I think, in particular. But he was in the house of the Surgeon General, who was able to restore him to life. But as I say, everything went very well. His concerts were sold out. The ones in Fishamble Street were totally full. They had to remove a pane of glass, like one of the first air conditioning systems in Europe to fit all the people inside. But as I say, it wasn't all plain sailing. And at one point, Jonathan Swift, of course, the author of Gulliver's Travels, he was in charge. He was a dean of St. Patrick's Cathedral. And it was those singers who were the singers, the gentlemen of the cathedral, who Handel was relying on heavily as soloists in Fishamble Street. And for some reason, Jonathan Swift has this hissy fit and suddenly says, "My singers are no longer allowed to sing in this kind of club of fiddlers on Fishamble Street. Like, these are religious gents. They shouldn't be involved at all with this secular music." So and he really meant it. They couldn't talk Jonathan Swift down. So Handel had to turn on a dime. And then and had to use other singers, so he used these theatre singers in Dublin. There was Maria Volio, who's an Italian soprano, who was there at the time. Mrs. Cibber, who was the alto, who was escaping from a scandal in London, and then a man called Callaghan McCarty, who was another theatre singer. So he rearranged Alexander's Feast for these three singers, and he had to rejig a lot of the individual movements. And we've been doing a lot of Indiana Jones style reconstruction to make together with academics who are all over Handel, and we've come up with this version that hasn't been heard since 1742. So it is a very well known Handel ode or oratorio, and we're now presenting it as it would have been heard in Dublin in 1742.
I'd like to hear a little of the music. I think that's quite important. Maybe you could introduce the first chorus we have here, which is "The Many Rend the Skies."
This is one of the first big choruses from Alexander's Feast, and basically it represents the courtiers who are delighted to hear. It's basically a troubadour who's praising Alexander, who's the best man in the world. He's like Arnold Schwarzenegger, the strongest person you could ever imagine. And they're applauding, literally applauding how great he is.
Let's take a little piece of that. And that is "The Many Rend the Skies," performed by the Arnold Schoenberg Choir and conducted by Alfredo Bernardini. I'm here with Peter Whelan, the Artistic Director and Conductor of the Irish Baroque Orchestra. I wanted to ask you, Peter, you do make Dublin sound like the most incredibly central part of the classical music world at that point. Like, there was a lot happening.
There was so much going on, and it's always lovely to be evangelical about it. Like, everywhere you go in the world, people are surprised to hear this heritage that we have in classical music, and it's always a surprise for Irish people as well. So it's just so much fun telling the story about it. I mean, it was a relatively peaceful time in Ireland. It was certainly very prosperous in the cities. There was a lot of money coming in. And of course, when that happens, things settle down. So we begin to have a concert scene, which didn't happen before. So the general public can go to concerts finally. There's a huge Handel mania before Handel arrives in Ireland. And people are just fascinated by music and music making and music printing and instrument making. So it's a real hub for the arts. And of course, all you have to do is look around, you know, Georgian Ireland, and you see this flourishing of all kinds of arts, whether it's architecture, you know, stucco work, painting. It's just a kind of a golden era.
Alexander's Feast, where does that stand in the history of Handel's repertoire?
Well, an interesting thing about Handel, especially in relation to Dublin, when he was here, he decided once and for all that he was done with opera. And that he was going to focus just on oratorio, mostly English language oratorio, which is also much cheaper for him to put on, and he could put it on in these public theatres. Alexander's Feast comes from about 6 years, I think about 1736. It's the beginning of his journey into this kind of world of odes and oratorios. He's experimental. So he's working with really high level English language text, and actually some of the text for Alexander's Feast was rejigged by a Handel's librettist, a guy called Newburg Hamilton, who was actually a dropout from Trinity College Dublin. So there's also that old claim that we can make to the text as well. So it was an important work for him, and I think he knew that it was hugely popular in London and that it would definitely be a hit when he came to Ireland.
Talk to me about how it's going to be performed, this particular version.
So this little version that we're doing, well, not little so much, but Handel, as I was saying earlier, had this problem when he was in Dublin that he'd have to rejig the whole thing. So the interesting thing is that the performances in London and the performances he did before were always in two parts, and he'd add a third part, he'd add some extra music to the end. It always varied. But in Dublin, he decided to make a third part to the performance, and that's what we can recreate for the first time. And the reason we know about this third part is basically through a libretto or a word book that was found in the Pierce Street Library, of all places, by this man called Donald Burroughs, who's a huge Handel scholar. And he's coming actually to our concert in Dublin. He's in his 80s, so he's very excited to hear this. So we have the word book. We also have Handel's conducting score, where he scribbles in pencil the names of the singers, so we can work out who the Dublin singers were. And until now, we knew that there was this extra piece in the third part written for Dublin. We had the words, we knew who was singing it, but everything was missing. The music was missing. Then, this is the Indiana Jones part, and somebody found like a bass part for the orchestra in the across from the Albert Hall in the Royal College of Music. So we had that bass line. And I've gone about reconstructing this one aria just so that we can have a whole run of this Irish version of the piece.
You make it sound incredibly exciting.
Oh, it is for me, but like I'm very nerdy about these things. But yeah, it's really been taking a lot of my time the last few months.
Oh, I want to play a second piece. This is Softly Sweet. It's a recording by the Irish Baroque Orchestra itself. Do you want to set that up for us?
Sure. I guess this is the most famous aria from Alexander's Feast. It's where the troubadour or the minstrel turns Alexander the Great's mind to love, and it's just a beautiful, simple lyrical melody.
Let's take a listen to that. And that is Softly Sweet in Lydian Measures. Rachel Redmond is the soprano, pardon me, the Irish Baroque Orchestra, conducted by Peter Whelan, who's with me now. Peter, finally, let's get on to the proms. It's your second visit as a performer, but your first as a conductor. Could you explain maybe how important an event it is in the classical music world for those people who maybe only ever catch a little bit of it on BBC Four once a year?
Sure. Well, it's a huge deal for any music group to be invited to the proms, and especially this time around, where we're only the second ever group from the Republic of Ireland to have attended the proms. So there's quite a bit of flag waving to go on with this too. I think it's a very proud moment for us, and definitely for our supporters and the Irish classical musicians in London. So it's a very big event. So it's nice to play this celebratory piece. It's nice that we can bring our own version, an Irish version of a Handel work. So, it feels like, in a lot of respects, the culmination of the work we've been doing over the years, kind of digging out this, you know, wonderful music and discovering this wonderful heritage we have in classical music. But yeah, it is, as you say, it's a big one, and there are butterflies in the stomach already.
It's been 3 years since you won an Olivier Award for Outstanding Achievement in Opera for the production of Bazaget that you were involved in. Can you quantify the impact that sort of win has on your company?
It was an amazing moment, and actually that was presented in the Royal Albert Hall as well. I think that was the last time I was there. Presented by Fiona Shaw, of course, who's also got an amazing opera director as well as being an amazing actor. But it's just such a huge place, and if, as I say, it's an amazing journey we're on. We're a small organisation in the Irish Baroque Orchestra, but we're plucky, and it feels like we're just on the right side of things at the moment. We're in a good place. It feels like we can sing and speak truth with the music that we're doing, and that speaks to people all over Europe at this point. And we have an American tour coming up next year. So all of this work is culminating, and the message that we're evangelizing seems to be ringing with people, which is, you know, we're so grateful for that. And it's just very gratifying that all of this is happening, really.
It's going to be an amazing time for you, I'm absolutely sure. Enjoy it.
Thank you.
My thanks to Peter Whelan. The Irish Baroque Orchestra and Choir will perform Alexander's Feast this Thursday as part of the Kilkenny Arts Festival at St. Canice's Cathedral. For more information, visit kilkennyarts.ie. And they will perform it this Friday in Dublin Castle and at the BBC Proms on the 30th of August. If you want to set that as a date, for information on those performances, visit irishbaroqueorchestra.com.